All right, so we are in Job chapter 5, and we are looking at Eliphaz's response to Job's lament that Job states in chapter 3. So we covered chapter 4 and got into a little bit of chapter 5 last week. I proposed that I see Eliphaz's initial response to Job's lament. Kind of, you can break it into three different sections. In the first section in chapter 4, Eliphaz is going to justify his right to speak and why he feels like he needs to speak up. And then second, he's going to talk extensively about this idea of how low man is compared to God. So there's a lot of emphasis in the moral distance between man and God, and therefore, he's going to draw some conclusions from that. And part of that is he talks about this shadowy figure who visits him at night, this kind of creepy scene where he recounts the things that was told to him from this figure. So then in the third section, I think we have Eliphaz trying to encourage Job. Here's what you need to do. And here's how it can still go well for you, okay? But here's what you need to do. I thought just before we get back into it, we'll look at chapter 5, verses 1 through 7 again, where we ended last week. But before we jump into it, just want to give kind of my overall view of, Job versus his friends. And a lot of times it'll come up like, okay, well, who's speaking truth here and who isn't? Because it isn't obvious. One thing we're going to look at this week is some of the things that Eliphaz said, where we can go to other passages and we can get the same thing. So it's not that the things that they were telling Job aren't aligned with Scripture or godly principles. But I think that obviously they're wrong. They're wrong in what they're telling Job. They're presuming to know things that aren't true, and they're stuck on this idea that this has to be what's happening when really that's not what's happening. And then Job, on the other hand, we are told from the beginning he's a blameless man. And I think throughout this whole exchange, we get some insight into his close relationship with God. We see how he's a humble person. We see him respond appropriately to God's rebuke later on in the book. But I don't think that everything Job is saying is right either. I think that he's off on some stuff, and I attribute that to him stumbling in his thoughts and his words because he's going through it right now. He's having a tough time. So I don't think you have a clear cut right and wrong here. I think it's a mix. It's a blend on both sides. So it's a little more complex, and you have to try to navigate, okay, how much of what each person is saying can I take for myself versus how much do I need to understand in the context of what's happening? They're not saying that the right way. So it's a little tricky working through it. But that's just kind of where I'm at in case you were wondering. It is such a dense study. It can get frustrating trying to figure out, okay, should I agree with this or is he wrong? So we'll just keep working through it as we can. But let's go back to Job chapter 5 and let's look at the first 7 verses again. This is following Eliphaz telling Job about this visitor that he got and the things that this visitor told him in chapter 4. I read Job chapter 5, verses 1 through 7, as a continuation of what this being, shadowy person, was telling him. That makes the most sense to me. It could be read as Eliphaz now speaking as well. So, look at it both ways, but we're going to analyze it from the perspective of this as the figure continuing in his speech. So starting in chapter 5, verse 1, he says, "Call now. Is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn? Surely vexation kills the fool, and jealousy slays the simple. I have seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling. His children are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. The hungry eat his harvest, and he takes it even out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth. For affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground, but man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward." So if we just break this down verse by verse, in verse 1, where it reads, "Call now, is there anyone who will answer you? To which of the holy ones will you turn?" If this is that same shadowy figure speaking, it's like he's saying, no one up there's listening to you. Who are you going to call to? Because there's no one paying attention to you. And in the context, it's because you don't deserve their attention. You are so much lower than them. Remember, this figure was telling Eliphaz, you know, the Almighty God charges his servants and his angels with error. How much more you who are made out of clay? Right? So to which one will you turn? Call now. Is there anyone going to answer you? Rhetorical question. No, no one's answering because no one cares. In verse 2, he says, "Surely vexation kills the fool and jealousy slays the simple." And this word vexation, the way I understand it, it's going to be used later by Job too. But it's a word that kind of covers all of the negativity that goes with this suffering that he's dealing with. It has to do with sorrow. It has to do with indignation and all these negative feelings that one would have if they're really being put through it and they feel like it's not fair. Okay. So vexation kills the fool and jealousy slays the simple. I read this as this figure is addressing man's reaction to the idea that he would call out and not be heard. Like, it makes him feel angry, like jealous. Like, why won't you listen to me? It's like, yeah, you're going to feel those things. You're going to be vexed. You're going to be jealous. But you know what? That's not going to produce results because you're going to die anyway. Verse 3, he says, "I have seen the fool taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling." And I can't help but see the parallel. And one of the reasons why I read this is this figure continuing his speech is because this is very similar to how the Satan sees Job in chapters 1 and 2, right? He sees him as this relationship seems to be bonding a little bit with God, and he's not at all impressed with that or pleased with that. He says, you know, "I see this thing taking root, but I cursed his dwelling." And that's exactly what the Satan ultimately did. He cursed Job. And he brought all this calamity upon Job. And then in verse 4, it goes to the different ways, which again parallel how Job himself had been cursed. His children are far from safety. In verse 4, they are crushed in the gate, and there is no one to deliver them. Wouldn't that just be awful to hear? I mean, if you'd just gone through what Job had gone through, and you'd lost your children, and now someone's telling you, you know what? For you foolish humans, I see how your children are crushed in the gate, and there's no one there to help them. That's tough. That's pretty nasty. Verse 5, he continues, "The hungry eat his harvest, and he even takes it out of thorns, and the thirsty pant after his wealth." Again, this goes back to the idea of what happened to Job, how these robbers came and plundered his things, and they burned his stuff, and they took from him unjustly. And then in verse 6, he says how affliction does not come from the dust, nor does trouble sprout from the ground, but man is born to trouble as the sparks fly upward. And I read this as he's saying that, I'm just reminding you, these things didn't just happen for no reason, right? They didn't just happen. It just didn't sprout up from the ground. But there's a reason that it happened, because someone is allowing it or causing it to happen who's greater than you. So again, remember your place, right? A lot of negativity here. And then we get into verse 8. I see the turn now as Eliphaz is going to speak. Because you have this turn, "As for me, I would seek God." So let's go ahead and read verses 8 through 16. Starting in verse 8, he says, "As for me, I would seek God, and to God I would commit my cause, who does great things and unsearchable, marvelous things without number. He gives rain on the earth and sends waters on the fields. He sets on high those who are lowly, and those who mourn are lifted to safety. He frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. He catches the wise in their own craftiness, and the schemes of the wily are brought to a quick end. They meet with darkness in the daytime and grope at noonday as in the night, but he saves the needy from the sword of their mouth and from the hand of the mighty. So the poor have hope, and injustice shuts her mouth." So what are some things that are noticeable to you in what Eliphaz says here in verses 8 through 16. Does anything kind of jump out to you? Anything stand out? Sean?
He's implying an awful lot about Job. It's not positive.
Yeah. Yeah, I obviously, you know, and this is going to become more and more apparent as we read through the discourse, but Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar believe that Job sinned and he needs to fix it. And you know, you can read that there's some indictments in here for sure. What else jumps out to you? Anything? Well, some of these principles are spiritual, godly principles, right? Let's look at a couple of other verses. Let's just jump over to the end of the Bible, Revelation chapter 3 and verse 19. You have this idea, and Eliphaz is going to hit this again later. He said, "Those whom I love, I reprove and discipline, so be zealous and repent." Is this not the core message that Eliphaz is trying to get across to Job? And it's a godly principle too, right? So again, it's not that he's necessarily off in his understanding on what God teaches when someone needs to repent, but the application isn't right here. And he's assuming some things that aren't true. And that's what's going to cause this whole back and forth that's about to happen. Something else that really jumped out to me, when you think about, again, how Eliphaz has just talked about what this figure had spoken to him, it seems like to me what really stands out in this passage is he's building on some ways or focusing on some ways in which this distance between man and God is evident. But that theme is here too. He's continuing that. So like, for example, in verse 11, he's talking about how God sets on high those who are lowly and those who mourn are lifted to safety. And then he contrasts that about how in verse 12, he frustrates the devices of the crafty so that their hands achieve no success. And he catches the wise in their own craftiness. So this idea that men who try to make something of themselves, who try to lift themselves up or handle something themselves, God's going to shut that down. But those who are poor or needy, God will lift up. And again, it's God doing the work, right? It's not man, because who is man? And I think that kind of follows in line with the things that he was told from this other figure. So in verse 16, he ends this section by saying, "The poor have hope, and injustice shuts their mouth." So the idea here, the conclusion he's drawing, is that your only hope is to recognize you're poor and you need God, and to stop trying to fix things yourself, Job. Stop trusting in your own righteousness. Stop trying to fix things yourself. The irony here, and there's a bit of irony, is that as we read these words from Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar later on, right now, even right now, they're positioning themselves as knowing both the mind of God and the mind of Job. And that's kind of the irony of it. They see themselves as qualified to instruct Job, that they're the ones who need to do it and set him straight. So there's a little bit of irony here. And I think that they're setting themselves up a little bit to be judged by the same words that they're speaking. So let's keep going. Or any other thoughts on that before we keep going? All right. Verse 17. Let's read through the end of the chapter. And again, just what we read a moment ago in Revelation 3, Job 5:17. "Behold, blessed is the one whom God reproves. Therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. For he wounds, but he binds up. He shatters, but his hands heal. He will deliver you from six troubles. In seven, no evil shall touch you. In famine, he will redeem you from death, and in war, from the power of the sword. You shall be hidden from the lash of the tongue, and shall not fear destruction when it comes. At destruction and famine, you shall laugh. and shall not fear the beasts of the earth, for you shall be in league with the stones of the field, and the beast of the field shall be at peace with you. You shall know that your tent is at peace, and you shall inspect your fold and miss nothing. You shall know also that your offspring shall be many, and your descendants as the grass of the earth. You shall come to your grave in ripe old age, like a sheaf gathered up in its season. Behold, this we have searched out. It is true. Hear and know it for your good. So, backing up to verse 17, there's another little bit of irony here that you'll see if you read ahead. But when he says, blessed is the one whom God reproves, therefore despise not the discipline of the Almighty. When it comes time for God to rebuke Job later on, how does Job reply to that? Does he despise it? He actually says, I despise myself. Those are actually his words. Yeah, John? Job chapter 5. Yeah. Verse 17. He says, I despise myself. So is the problem with Job despising the discipline of the Almighty? Well, we got proof later on that it's not. But then you also have later on, Rod and I actually texted about this a little bit over the week. But later on, God's not as pleased with the response of Job's three friends when God issues this rebuke. And it becomes apparent that God's rebuking all of them. But we see Job has this humble response to it. And you don't see anything at all from these three guys. I mean, it's kind of like the implication is they didn't think that they needed to change anything. So, I mean, who's kind of despising the discipline of the Lord here? So, again, a little bit of irony going on. If you read ahead, you can see that. And again, these guys aren't irredeemable or evil by any means. But they're definitely off on some stuff. So, let's see here. Just out of order a little bit. So one of the things that Eliphaz is trying to get Job to see is that, you can have peace again, you can have prosperity again. He's promising all these nice things. But if you look at it from Job's perspective, what reason is there to believe that this is true? Because from Job's perspective, I haven't done anything wrong. Right? If it's true, if what you're saying is true, that God blesses those who are righteous and he's going to lift them up and he's going to help the ones who need help, then why isn't it happening right now? That's Job's perspective. So why isn't it happening? And you can kind of start to see how maybe through the ears of these three friends, maybe it sounds like they're encouraging him, right? They're trying to build him up. But through Job's ears, he's just getting more frustrated with this. Because he's like, you guys don't know what you're talking about. If what you're saying is true, then it would be happening to me. And they're going to hear that and say, stop thinking you're so great that it should be happening to you. And he's saying, but it's not that. It's not that. And this impasse is going to remain. So, let's see. Yeah, and jumping down to verse 25, I want to make sure I hit some of these points. Again, when he says, you shall know that your offspring shall be many and your descendants as the grass of the earth. Again, that's pretty bold. That's a pretty bold thing to say to a man who's just lost all his kids. That's not empathetic, right? That's like, I'm going to hit you with the hardcore doctrinal stuff. This is how God operates, but without regard to empathy. And Job's going to jump all over that when Job replies. He's going to say things like, look, I didn't ask you to come here and fix my problems. Like, why don't you just show me some pity? I didn't ask for this. And this kind of statement I see is being without pity. Again, it's not necessarily speaking untruth about how God would operate. You can go to other passages that read something similar. But how it's being used is not perhaps the wisest way. But then again, let's balance this out. In verse 26, Eliphaz says, you shall come to your grave in ripe old age like a sheaf gathered up in its season. The concluding remark that Eliphaz here comes back around to basically saying, Job, you want to die right now, but I don't want you to die. And it concerns me that you want to die. That you said your hope is just let God leave me alone and let me die. And then let's just end it. And I see that as Eliphaz is, he doesn't want his friend to die. And he's trying to help him. I do think he thinks he's helping. So it's not going to end up being helpful, but he's trying to help. And again, I'll just say I've been there myself. I've said things sometimes for people that I thought was going to help them, and it made things a lot worse. And Bonnie's not here this morning, but she would agree with that if she were here. So now we're going to head into Job's reply to Eliphaz's words here. But do you have any other observations or questions that we didn't cover? Yes. Yes, great point.
There's nothing new in any of this.
Yeah.
And I think that frustrates Job even more.
Yes.
Because he already knew that he's probably the one who taught this to him. And so, it's the frustration in Job you can see starting to build.
Yeah.
And the reason is you're not giving me any new information. You're not giving me any insight. I already knew all of this. I still don't know what's going on. But you're just telling me the same thing I already know.
Yeah.
And I think that's where a lot of his frustration is going to come from. It's like, I don't know that they're accusing him at this point. Maybe, maybe not. It's hard to say. But I know as it goes further down, if they start doing that, then his frustration boils over. And that just seems to be almost like a precursor. He already knew all of this. It's nothing new. He already knew all of this.
Right.
So it's not comfort. It's not accusation. It's just...
Yeah.
But it doesn't help me at all.
Yeah, and it's I think a couple of chapters from now, it's even kind of funny reading Job's reaction along those points, what you're saying. He says sarcastically, "Surely wisdom will die with you." Right? And he does talk about that very thing. He's like, "Look, I know what you're saying. You think I don't know this?" And in chapter 7 he's gonna end by saying, like, you know, is my palate not able to discern the cause of my own calamity? Like, look at me. He says, look me in the eye. I'm not trying to, like, pull one over on you here. I know what's going on. Why don't you believe what I'm saying? So, yeah, very good point. Very good point. It does frustrate him because he knows all these things. All right, so let's read his response to Eliphaz. We're just going to work through this kind of verse by verse. And some of this is a little difficult, and I'll just tell you the parts that I had difficulty with. You can tell me what you think. All right, so chapter 6, verse 1. Then Job answered and said, "Oh, that my vexation were weighed, and all my calamity laid in the balances. For then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words have been rash." So again, this idea of vexation, meaning all these negative thoughts and feelings that accompany going through this trial. It's being having sadness and sorrow and pain and indignation that you have to deal with it. And all these negative concepts are kind of covered in this word. And he's saying, if that were weighed and my calamity laid in the balances, it would be heavier than even the sands of the sea. And this idea where he says, my words have been rash. I don't think that what he's saying here is that he says he regrets anything he said to this point. What he means by this is that his words fall short of adequately expressing his grief and his sorrow. I think that's the meaning behind it. So it's just a way that he's, again, emphasizing the amount of sorrow that he's going through. So then in verse 4, he says, "For the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison. The terrors of God are arrayed against me." And again, he's bringing it back over to where the cause of this lies. It's not with him, it's with God. God's causing this to happen to me. And, you know, as we're going to see as we go, Job continues to argue that, look, if I'm the problem, then why won't God just show me where the problem is so I can fix it? Like, isn't that how God operates? If he wants me to repent, I have to know what I did wrong. But he's not showing me what I did wrong. So what am I supposed to do? I just have to conclude that I've done nothing wrong, or God doesn't want me to repent of it. And either way, that's not going to end up good for me. So then verses 5 through 7. This is one of those difficult passages. And you can tell sometimes because if depending on the version you have or translation you have, there'll be some footnotes in here where it's like the translator was like, yeah, this isn't really clear what this means. And there's like a few of these in here. So the translation didn't go from Hebrew to English or Hebrew to Greek if you're from the Septuagint to English very, very easily. But verse 5 through 7, he says, does the wild donkey bray when he has grass, or the ox low over his fodder? So I understand this first part to mean that he's saying that donkeys and oxen don't complain unless they have a reason. You know, when they have grass to eat, or they're able to, you know, eat, they're not going to complain for no purpose. They're going to complain when they're being deprived of these things. I also see this as Job kind of expressing some self-awareness at the quality of his own arguments. He's kind of comparing himself, I think, to the donkey who is braying, to this animal, this wild animal that's got this problem that it doesn't know how to fix, and all he can do is just complain about it. The donkey's not able to fix this problem, but he can make noise. So I think Job is kind of saying that too, and that's going to tie back into, like if you jump down for a minute to verse 26. He says, do you think that you can reprove words when the speech of a despairing man is wind? It's like he's saying, I'm not really giving you a lot of solid content here to work with. So, you know, don't read a whole lot into what I'm trying to say. I'm frustrated and I'm having trouble right now, I think is the idea. So you see this self-awareness that Job has, that he's just struggling. And then verses 6 through 7, I'm not sure, honestly, what this means. But it says, can that which be tasteless, which is tasteless, be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the juice of the mallow? My appetite refuses to touch them. They are as food that is loathsome to me. So this could go back around to, you know, it could be another point he's making following this idea of the donkey not braying when he has grass. Or it could tie into something like if you jump ahead to Job chapter 12 and verse 11. Job says later on, he says, does not the ear test words as the palate tastes food? So it could have the idea there that he's saying that I don't enjoy bad tasting food in the same way. What you're saying doesn't taste good to my ears, right? There's nothing good happening there. However, that's just a couple of ideas, and you know I don't stand on that with a whole lot of confidence because it's not clear to me what that means. Verses 8 through 9, he says, oh, that I might have my request and that God will fulfill my hope. And what was his hope at this point? In verse 9, he tells you that it would please God to crush me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. So that's just another way of saying Job's kind of without hope at this point. And maybe not completely, utterly, entirely without any hope, because he's still here and he's still making points that he hopes his friends will understand and agree with. And he still talks about what it might be like if he were able to go before God and make his case before God. But you're talking about on the brink of hopelessness if he hasn't already crossed it. And then in verse 10, this is another one of those verses that's hard for me to understand, and the translation doesn't go very naturally. He says, this would be my comfort. I would even exult in pain unsparing, for I have not denied the words of the Holy One. So I think it's clear he's just talking about, or he's emphasizing how much he wants to die. He just wants it to be over. But beyond that, exactly his point that he's making, I'm not sure. I know that this idea, or this word denied, when he says, I have not denied the words of the Holy One, that could also be translated concealed. I have not hidden away his words. And there's also some confusion in the translation around when he says, I would even exult in pain unsparing. That word unsparing, it's unclear whether that refers to the pain or whether that refers to God not sparing Job. So there's just like, depending on how you interpret that, that can mean a lot of different things. So I'm not real sure exactly what it means. Yeah, John? Yeah. What fits with the rest of what Job is? I mean, that fits really well. And what the parts of that that fit really well is Job maintains his integrity, that he's not sinned against God. Right? So the idea that he hasn't denied the words of the Holy One, that fits that pretty well. But just know that in some of these passages, there is some difficulty with the translation, or at least the ones who are trying to explain the translation, that they don't understand very well. It could be on me. verse 11, he says, what is my strength that I should wait? And what is my end that I should be patient? Is my strength the strength of stones? Or is my flesh bronze? Have I any help in me when resource is driven from me? So again, I think Job is saying here that he doesn't have any strength. It's a rhetorical question. What is my strength that I should wait? It's like he's saying, what's the point of me hoping that God will restore me at some point, like you're saying, Eliphaz? You know, why should I wait for that? What reason do I have to believe that that's going to happen? Like, I don't have the fortitude to manage that right now. He doesn't have the strength. And he says, have I any help in me when resource is driven from me? So, again, it kind of just ties back again to this idea of Job saying, you know, things are kind of looking hopeless for him. And I think he's saying that he's pretty convinced that there's no good thing coming around the corner for him. He's kind of lost hope that this might turn around and start picking up. So then verse 14, he says, he who withholds kindness, or did I skip anything? No, I didn't. Okay, good. He who withholds kindness from a friend forsakes the fear of the Almighty. And I think this comes back around to what we were talking about. Job is saying, look, why don't you just show me pity instead of trying to find what's wrong with me? Show me some kindness. Why are you withholding kindness from me? And then here comes the rebuke coming back to his friends. In verse 15, he says, my brothers are treacherous as a torrent bed, as a torrential streams that pass away, which are dark with ice and where the snow hides itself. When they melt, they disappear. When it is hot, they vanish from their place. The caravans turn aside from their course. They go up into the waste and perish. The caravans of Tema look. The travelers of Sheba hope. They are ashamed because they were confident. They come there and are disappointed. For you have now become nothing. You see my calamity and are afraid. So what's he talking about here with this whole image of this torrential stream that's passing away and the snow and the ice that melt? You guys have any ideas how that might describe what's happening here? Yeah, Rod?
It's not true, but really you're saying you're really worthless friends. You're just like a stream that's not there that people look for and it's not there. And I really wish you'd been more help to me.
Yeah, and the idea too, like these torrential streams, it makes me think about like when it rains real hard and you have these streams that can form and this water is just rushing. When I grew up in San Antonio behind our house, we had this creek that ran behind our house, and when it would rain real hard, it would be like whitewater rapids, you know. But like in a day or two, it would be just bone dry again. And I think that's the image I come back to when I read this. He's saying like, yeah, you're like those streams. Where, yeah, you look like you're really strong and you're really something and there's substance there, but in a couple of days, that's gone. And even while you're here, who's going to try to go down there and get water from that? It's pretty treacherous to try to get any benefit from that even while it's there. So it's like a thorough rebuke of what they're saying, right? You know, even the things you're saying, I think that he's going to accuse them later of trying to trip him up in what he's saying. So he sees that what they're saying is like treacherous, not just empty or worthless, but also treacherous. It's a pretty scathing rebuke from Job. And it's interesting in verse 21, he says, "For you have now become nothing," finishing that thought. "You see my calamity and are afraid." What do you guys think about that? Like, why does he perceive that they're afraid, and what does that have to do with anything? Why would they be afraid? Yeah?
One thought is there's again, the theory, and then there's the reality. You know, like, they were confident, and then they come, and they're disappointed. And now that they're seeing reality in play, and they're not equipped for this, and they are way over their heads.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. They're not equipped for this, the reality of this situation. They've obviously studied about God, and they know how God handles these situations, and they're ready to talk about that, but they're not ready for this. Yeah.
This whole interchange reminded me of my first couple years of marriage, and that there were some times toward the end of the clock, and I would try to fix. And the reality is, she just wanted to vent, okay? And as a man, I'm sitting here and I'm trying to make logic out of the situation. So as I read through this and I think through this, they sat there for seven, we've got to remember, his friends sat there for 7 days and didn't say a word.
Right, they sat there 7 days.
Amazing, right? And I'm imagining that Eliphaz is the extrovert in the group, because as soon as Job says something, I can talk and blurts out, you know, and is trying to fix the problem. He's trying to apply logic to what's going on. And Job's just like, man, I just wanted that. Can't you just have pity for me and let me vent for a second?
Yeah.
And not try to fix my problems? And this is going to terrify you because you're trying to apply logic to this. And I got to tell you, there's no logic. And you're going to be scared because you're trying to think logically how this happened to you. And now do I have to... But the reality is, man, there's no logic here.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I see it the same way when he talks about how they're afraid. I think they're afraid to confront a reality where God may actually be doing what Job says. It's kind of a scary reality to think. Because again, Job doesn't see the end of this yet, right? Where Job is now, God's forsaken him and he doesn't know why. But hey, here's some new information for you guys. Apparently, sometimes God forsakes people and he doesn't tell them why. That's a pretty scary reality. And we can say, and I have in the past, perhaps too academically, well, God has a right to do that. I mean, he won't, but who are we to tell him he can't? Right from the perspective of kind of like going back to what this shadowy figure was saying, you know, the distance between me and God, if God decided he wanted to treat his creation this way, I don't have a right to go to him and tell him he can't do that. But where does that leave me in my relationship with God? Is that not terrifying? To think that that could be the God that we worship? And I thank him that it's not. And that we have the rest of this story to tell us that's not the God that we worship. But if I'm in Eliphaz's shoes right now, and I'm having to wrestle with what Job's telling me, I don't want to accept the truth of what he's saying. I'm considerably motivated to not believe that's the God that I serve. Yeah, Billy?
Absolutely. And so there's a lot of
Yeah.
I, not to put Job on a pedestal, but at the same time, I mean, this book exists because, in part, Job was able to go through this.
Yeah.
So he's probably got insight into these guys' reactions that is accurate, and they have insight into his situation that is totally inaccurate, but it makes sense based on what they know. I mean, it's reasonable.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, and you know, I can see that in myself if I'm trying to analyze myself at times when I'm confronted with something I don't agree with. Just recognize that sometimes the fear of accepting something that I don't believe is true can motivate me to argue against it. I mean, that's just human nature, right? I mean, we don't want to be tossed by every wind and wave of doctrine, right? And rightly so. So it's a tricky thing to know how to navigate. And again, I'm not trying to elevate or excuse the things that Eliphaz said, but man, he's not in an easy spot here. He's hearing stuff that he never thought he'd hear from Job, and he's having to wrestle with it. And he feels the burden that we feel when someone's saying something wrong to say something right and correct them. I mean, we can relate to that. So we're going to finish here. We'll just read through verse 23, and then we'll pick up, Lord willing, next week. Verse 21, for now you've become nothing. You see my calamity and are afraid. Verse 22, very much to Rick's point. He says, have I said, make me a gift, or from your wealth offer a bribe for me, or deliver me from the adversary's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the ruthless? I read that as he's saying, did I ask you to fix my problems? Did I come to you looking to solve this? No, back up to verse 14. Stop withholding kindness from me. Stop forsaking your friend. And then at the end of chapter 7, he's going to implore them, look, believe what I'm saying. What reason do you have to believe that I'm speaking mistruth or I'm trying to say something else? Now, interesting in chapter 7, though, he's going to turn his focus from his friends to God. And in a very dramatic fashion, I see him speaking to the sky and shaking his fists and yelling these things. Maybe it didn't really happen that way. But he says some pretty bold things, asking God, why are you doing this to me? And of course, his friends are not going to appreciate that very much. They're going to see that as pretty much blasphemous. Thank you for your good attention and for your comments. And we'll try to pick up next week where we left off.